Los Angeles. You're now tuned into Slauson Girl Speaks
with award-winning journalist and South Central native, Slauson Girl.
This is a safe space.
Yeah!
Celebrating authentic black expression.
Where Slauson Girl dives deep
into Los Angeles history,
politics, and news.
While discussing culture, race, and identity with carefully curated guests
to keep you open-minded in today's society.
No cap.
Follow Slauson Girl on all social media platforms and stream Slauson Girl Speaks on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You don't want to miss this.
Agent Sonny Jones. If you need a home, call Sonny Jones. She can help you buy or sell your home. Luxury or income property. Agent Sunny is the one that you want to see.
Hi, I'm Sunny Jones, your community real estate partner. Real estate ownership is key to building generational wealth, and it matters who you work with. Whether you're buying or selling, I am here to help you win. Let's chat. You can find me at agentsunnyjones.com, Facebook and Instagram, or by text 323-793-7651. If you need a home, call Sunny Jones. 323-793-7651.
So when you need a home, call Sunny Jones. When you need a home, call Sunny.
On this episode of Slauson Girl Speaks, I have the pleasure of speaking with Jasmine Kanick, who is a journalist, political commentator, and strategist, and somebody in the Los Angeles media landscape whose name you definitely need to put some respect on. And so today, in Women's History Month, I wanted to highlight Jasmine and have a conversation about Black women in journalism in LA and her journey to where she is today. So, Jasmine, how are you?
Hey, I'm so happy to finally be here with you.
I know. We've been throwing some dates around and finally was able to make it happen today. So I really do appreciate your time. I know you're a busy person. Dot connecting in the city. But I know recently you recently returned from Jamaica.
I did.
And you were actually working out there, working on a podcast. Can you talk a little bit about your project and how was that experience?
So I have a lot of friends who are Jamaican.
Okay.
Who live here in the States and then particularly here in LA.
Okay.
And one of those friends has been on me for a long time to come see the work that he was doing in Jamaica. Now, my friend Nevin used to live here in LA, but then he had moved to Florida. And I kind of didn't know exactly what made him decide to move to Florida, but he told me the reason why was because of the murder of this young Black man in Jamaica. He wanted to move to Florida to be closer not only to his family, but closer to Jamaica, because he started to do a lot more work in Jamaica after that, because he was moved. He was so moved by this murder of this person who was at a party. It was in front of hundreds of people. They ran over him with a car. They set him on fire. They left his body in a ditch. All because he was gay. And even though I have a lot of friends who are Jamaican, and mostly all of my Jamaican friends are queer, and they're like my age and older. So that means they came here when they were younger with their parents, like in the 80s, and the 70s. A lot of them have dual citizenship. And Nevin's one of those folks, so he would go back and forth. And so he ended up setting up a safe house to help hide gay people in Jamaica. Remind people, these are Black people. These are Black Jamaicans who are being persecuted and chased down and murdered in the streets. Government has no problem with it. They base it all off of the religion that we exported from America there. So a lot, you know, Jamaica has the most churches per square mile as well as bars, but their churches are, a lot of them are American based. So your Pentecostal, Baptist, where they failed here with gay rights, they have succeeded in the Caribbean and Africa with this sort of conservative brand of Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. So Nevin wanted me to come down and check it out. And when I went, I said that people need to know about this, because most of the time when we go to Jamaica, we just know about the tourist corridor that's carefully curated for us. Beautiful white sand, beautiful beaches. Like, no one goes beyond that. We don't go past Negril, past Mo Bay, Montego Bay, Ocho Rios. We, you know, we don't go into the actual country, and we don't know what life is like for people and what's going on. Right. And I thought it was particularly irrelevant to do a podcast, because when I look at all the other countries, America sticks its business into, like, Afghanistan and Iran and Pakistan and other places where queer people are being mistreated. Even here in the U.S., we always have a lot to say. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, why don't we have anything to say about what's going on in Jamaica? Oh, that's right, because we vacay down there. And if we vacay and this is going on and then we know about it, we kind of have a responsibility to do something about it. So nobody wants to talk about it or acknowledge it, because no one wants to stop vacationing in Jamaica.
Right.
But you know what? People's lives are more important than that, right?
Right.
So I spoke to an editor I work with at Advocate Magazine, which is a, you know, a queer national magazine, and asked if they wanted to partner with me on it. And I just put it together. And I've been going back and forth to Jamaica, speaking with folks in literal secrecy, because, you know, if people knew where the safe house was, they would burn it down. If people knew certain people were gay, they would chase them out of their neighborhoods. Like, it's that bad there. And, you know, I'm a Black, what's the word? What's the politically correct word today? A Black cisgendered, I don't know, lesbian. I don't know what the hell. I'm a lady who dresses like a lady who likes being a lady. Go fancy that one. So people just assume that I'm this heterosexual woman. So nobody messes with me in that sense, right. Except for their, hey, baby, where's your man? I still got to get that down there, you know? Right. But yeah, so that's why I go back and forth to Jamaica. The podcast is called Ring the Alarm. It's wherever you listen to your podcast at. You can find it, Apple, Google, Amazon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I'm really proud of it. I tell people all the time, I don't care if only 10 people listen to it. I'm still proud of it, because these stories are important and these voices are important. It's not me. It's them. Right. I'm just, my friend asked me to do it just because he knew I had the audience, right? Mm-hmm. And I believe if you're going to have an audience, if people want to pay attention to me and what I'm doing, at least let me be responsible about it. Right. Let me use it in a way that helps other people. And so this is one of those projects that I'm extremely happy to be doing that with.
Okay, definitely. And so you said people could listen to it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and all that?
Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music.
Oh, wow.
Just pretty much everywhere you find your podcasts, you can get it. And they can always get it on my website at iamjasmine.com.
Okay, definitely. So what were some of your biggest takeaways from being in Jamaica and doing this reporting?
There were a lot. I mean, one is that we take life so for granted. I mean, I wish for everyone the opportunity to travel internationally to understand that we are the exception and not the rule here in America. Most people don't live like we live. And I've been to China. I've been to Africa. I've been to the West Indies. To Europe. I've been a lot of places. I've been blessed to go to a lot of places. That's cool. Right? I've been to Central America, right? So I understand that we are the exception to the rule. I go places where they don't have indoor plumbing. There are places in Jamaica where people are literally living in huts on the side of the road. Okay, there is no indoor plumbing. There are places where a van drives up a hill and provides internet for that rural community village for a couple of hours once a week. Okay. I've you know, and so I'm constantly reminded that no matter how bad I think I have it here as a Black woman, I'm still privileged and have it a lot better than my counterparts in other countries.
Right.
I am also reminded again that there is a hierarchy into lives that matter, particularly in the queer community. You know, I wrote a piece not too long ago about how we're all up in arms over how the gay Ukrainians are going to be treated under a Russian, under Russian rule. And I'm not taking anything away from that. But I was like, okay, wait. Okay, now this just recently happened or is happening. What's going on in Jamaica and Ghana and other parts of the world where Black queer people have been persecuted, murdered, state-sanctioned violence has been going on for decades, and we have found no reason to get involved or say anything.
Right.
But within several days of the Russians invading Ukraine, front page of the LA Times, what about the gay Ukrainians? I'm just like, okay, just another reminder that even when you're queer, if you're Black, you move to the bottom of the list in terms of the hierarchy of the importance of your life.
Right. Well, that is never a good feeling ever.
No, it's not.
I definitely hear you in terms of the coverage, not just specifically being gay in Ukrainian and Russia, but just like the whole thing. It's front page news everywhere. It's all CNN is talking about right now. I'm just like, did all the problems in America just come to a halt? Like, you know?
Or everywhere else in the world, rather.
Right. You know, so, but hey.
White people in despair.
I hope for peace over there, but we seen what y'all was doing to the Africans. So.
Well, hello and goodbye. And like, that's not something to even gloss over, right? We should pause and talk about that, right? Because as journalists, we have a responsibility to not just focus on white people.
Right.
Our media is very good at focusing on white people. As a matter of fact, they employ millions of white people to do nothing but focus on white people and have the occasional token Black or brown person lying around for a Black or brown story usually.
Right.
And then there's that rare Black or brown person that forgets they are Black or brown and could succeed in the white man's world because they look in the mirror and see a white person. Whereas the rest of us see who the hell they really are. Right. No names. Shout out to CNN. So when I'm seeing these hashtags about Africans in Ukraine on social media, and I'm looking at these videos and these images of how Africans are being treated in Ukraine, I'm saying to myself, how come this isn't on the front page of the LA Times? And why isn't this on the front page of the New York Times? Where you at, Don Lemon? Where y'all at on this? I mean, every other pro-Black people this, Black people that. These are Black people in Ukraine. Do right. you stop being Black the minute you leave the U.S. or something? You know, like we no longer care about Blackness outside of the country. And I'm still very disappointed in the coverage that the tree. It's like nobody wants to call out the elephant in the room. Call the elephant out in the room. Call the elephant out in the room.
Right.
You have people literally saying you can't leave because you're not white.
Right.
Yet I'm being asked every day. I don't care if I'm on my phone. I don't care if I'm on the computer, watching TV, to give money to some cause to help Ukraine. Well, I'm going to give my money to some organization in a country that is badly treating Black people. I actually started seeking out the organizations helping the Black people in Ukraine. Right. That's who I'm going to give my money to.
Right. Definitely. So what do you think is kind of being, why do you think that the Africans are being treated like that in Ukraine to where they, you know, they're trying to stop them or we're trying to stop them from boarding trains and things like that?
Like,
anti-blackness, white supremacy.
Well, what else could there be?
Right.
Let's be rational. There's no other reason for them to stop them from leaving other than the fact that they are being anti-black.
Right.
They are putting white Ukrainians first.
Right. But.
And don't care if they get killed after they're left behind. Clearly.
Ooh. They were saying, though, that there was a hierarchy in terms of like Ukrainians first. Right. And then the other people. But then that group, black people, is always at the bottom. You know what I'm saying? Because it's not POC as much as it is being anti-black. So what they're saying is like, no, we're not racist against the black people specifically. We just have a policy to make sure all the Ukrainians get on first. But then after that, it was like the Indian folks, or not Indian.
Oh, girl.
But like another demographic. And then the black people were like, you know, because on the totem pole, we're at the bottom, allegedly.
I hear you. So do you think when the Russians are pinpointing what they bombing next, they look, those aren't white Ukrainians, those Africans over there. Okay, don't we think a bomb right there.
Right.
Tell you what though, there's a hierarchy with my dollars. I tell you that much, with my donation dollars that I put aside to help out causes, I got a hierarchy with those too.
Right.
And guess who's at the bottom of the totem pole when it comes to those dollars? Guess who?
Non-black.
Because that's the attitude we have to have.
Right.
You know, I remember one morning I got up really early. I was watching CNN and I was really impressed by a member of parliament that was on CNN. She spoke so eloquently. I really loved everything she had to say about how the U.S. was putting the price of gas and all these other things that had a human life. And I'm like, I'm in the bed. Yes, girl. Yes, yes. But then, you know, at the same time, I had to say, oh, girl, but your people are racist. You know, I have to balance it all out. Like, right. She made perfect sense, but her people are still racist.
Right.
And, you know, where you at, VP? You know, this might be a great time to step up and speak up for the black side of you, the black folks. You know, I mean, we need someone that I don't expect President Biden to do it, although it would be nice. Hmm. We need someone at that level, though, to call that out.
Right.
They're asking for us to initiate a no-fly zone. They're asking for us to put our men and women in harm's way in terms of in basically boots on the ground and go into war. Mm-hmm. But we have certain values in this country. And as a part of those values, we allegedly treat people equally. We cannot put our money and resources into helping a country that's not doing the same.
Right.
I don't know why every Black civil rights organization isn't speaking up about this. I mean, could you imagine if something like that was happening here? And they said, well, there's a hierarchy to the people who can lead first.
Right.
And Black people was at the bottom of that. Could you just imagine? How long you think that would last?
Right.
They'd be more worried about the internal threat than the external threat. Okay.
Right.
Okay. But remember, these Africans are already out of their native land.
Right.
They're from the Congo, wherever they're from, they're not at home as it is.
Right.
And now they're being moved again.
Right.
They have to move again.
Well, prayers for the Africans. Hope y'all can get up out of there ASAP. For the people that are still behind, because I know there have been a lot of people that have gotten out of there. But, okay, kind of pivoting from Russia to Ukraine. I hope the gas goes down really soon. But journalism, you know. You mentioned, you know, being Black in journalism and things like that. And how long have you been in the field of journalism?
How long have I been in the field? As long as I can remember, as long as I could write.
Ooh.
So I've always wanted to be a writer.
Okay.
That was my thing when I was younger. I was like, I went through a couple of phases. Writing was one of them, but it was one that stuck with me through school. So I was a really good writer.
Okay.
And I'm like really nosy. It's such a great combination.
To be a journalist, right? And
I just remember I just started writing my opinions. I wrote a lot of op-eds and I started getting invitations to go on radio. back when Roland was still at WVON on Chicago. Me and Roland Martin, we became really close. I was a frequent guest on his radio show.
Nice.
I would do a lot of shows here in LA. I started getting invites to go on, you know, national television because I had an opinion, I had something to say, and I was articulate, knew how to write it out and make it all make sense. And, you know, I dabbled in radio, still do radio every now and then, which is obviously clearly why I have a podcast, right? I love radio. I love all forms of journalism. But I think for me, you know, I made a very conscientious decision in my personal life to always be a writer no matter what I do. So I don't care what I do, I'm always going to write. Like a part of me is always going to be a journalist. There's going to be something. Like even now, even though, you know, I run this, you know, strategic consulting firm and I do all this other stuff, I still make time to do things like your show, to go on television and talk about issues and to write about issues because I believe it's important to do. And at the time that I started, there weren't a lot of Black female voices in the arena. There were a lot of Black male voices out there, but not a lot of young 20-something-year-olds with something to say about politics. And now there is, and I'm happy that there is. I'm not a hater. Like I'm really happy that there is, but I do remember when there wasn't. And so, I mean, you know, people ask me all the time, well, how come you didn't go into journalism full time and this and that? Because it was a choice I made. I wanted to make a certain amount of money. I'm not saying that journalists don't get paid a lot, but, you know, you got to be like working at the New York Times or something to get paid a salary that you could just be a journalist on and not have to do anything else.
Right.
I mean, it seems like, except when it comes to Black women, you could be white and have 15. Well, they're an actor and a waiter, and they also drive Uber, and no one bats an eye. But when you're a Black woman, it's like, you do what and what and what? It's like, what? This is 2022. Everyone has multiple talents and multiple streams of income.
Right.
Right. And so for me, you know, journalism feeds my passion as well as, you know, a couple coins on the side here and there. Because the days of me writing for free are long over. no, they take advantage of you.
Yeah, definitely.
For a long time. But I'd have made my name now. So, but yeah, so, you know, I do the stuff as I can do it. You know, I know there are people who just wish I'd sit around and write about the police all day long as if I had nothing better to do. Because for 5 years I covered the LAPD and you would have thought I had never written about anything else but the LAPD. And I'm glad I broke a lot of stories, shed light on a lot of scandals, but I was a writer and a commentator before the LAPD. Was going to be one after I was done. So I basically kind of stepped back after Chief Beck left in terms of writing regularly on the LAPD. Now, here and there, I may write some stuff. I mean, the LAPD is a messed up organization. It's going to be, there's going to always be something to write about when it comes to the LAPD.
Right.
I love the fact the officers and deputies in the sheriff's department still, you know, come to me as a trusted source, because I never gave up any of my sources. And it, depending on what the story is, I may still write about it, but I don't do it on like a every day. I mean, I was running circles around the LA Times for a minute back in the day, but I don't do that. And, you know, it's not, it was only always for a set time, but, you know, I try to stick to race, politics and sort of the intersection of race and politics and social issues. That's really where I thrive at. Okay. We got a lot of issues. We got a lot of issues. And usually at the center of those issues is either race or politics. And sometimes we don't want to talk about those issues. We want to dance around them. We don't, we want to ignore it. Like how I was saying earlier about you know, what was going on in Ukraine. With that, like, we just want to talk around stuff. We want to act like stuff isn't going on. Same mm-hmm. thing with Jamaican, what's going on. And I'm that person. No. We going to talk. Oh, let's just talk about it. Let's just have a conversation. It might not be a pleasant conversation. Might be hard to have. But let's have that conversation. Right. Because we can't keep ignoring things, acting like they're not happening.
Right. No, I agree. Definitely. So from your time in journalism, how have you come to view the importance of journalism? Like, how important is that to not only society, but I guess in particular, Black communities?
Well, I mean, journalism has always been important. It's been really important to Black communities because there was a time when we wouldn't get covered in white newspapers. So we started our own newspapers and we hired our own journalists.
Right.
We had Black men and women who published their own newspapers for their own communities and still do to this day. Shout out to the NNPA, National Newspaper Publishers Association.
Hmm.
And then we went through, which I currently believe we're still in to some extent, that phase of white papers reporting on Black people, either using white disconnected reporters or Black disconnected reporters,
right?
Who just exploit stories, or just flat out steal stories,
right?
Or just it's not really about the actual
issue.
Yeah, that too. I mean,
it's for visibility.
A couple of things I think about, you know. I've watched reporters use story for their own. They could care less about what was going on to the subject of their story. They just
it's for visibility for them.
And some people will argue, oh, it's not our job as journalists, blah, blah, blah. It's whatever you make your job to be. I don't just extract out of people without putting something back.
Hmm.
I have made it a priority not to just take from people. But I get access, people who have sons killed, their parents killed by the police, all kinds of horrific situations. And I'll get phone calls. Can you interview them? Can you talk to them? And so I just have to make a decision on whether or not I'm going to do it. But then if I do decide to do it, I make it a point not to just take from these people, right? And what does that mean? It means different things. When I was in Jamaica, I remember going down to the gully, which is like our Skid Row in LA, but like for queer people, like where they, and I remember them, there's so many people. And I remember them saying to me, all the white reporters do is come down here and take from us. They just want our pictures. They just want our images. They complain to me about Vice. They complain to me about the BBC. They complain about how these people came down, these reporters, some of them Black, but all working for these other folks, taking advantage of them, making them all these promises, and them never hearing from them again. Although, when you go and Google, you know, queer Jamaicans and the Vice story, because they ran the story. Let's be clear, the stories ran.
But no resources for the people?
No resources, nothing. So when I interview people in Jamaica, I pay them. Do they ask me to pay them? No. I have to pay them? I do not. But I'm also an American who's getting on a plane, coming back to a nice, comfortable place to live. And these people are living in a gully.
Right.
And I don't feel any kind of ways about giving them money to speak with me. Nine times out of 10, they don't even expect it. And I don't even give it to them until we're done. They're always surprised, right? But I have to find my own ways, like I said, to not just take from people.
Right.
We do an awful lot of taking from people in journalism and not enough putting back. Do a lot of that. Like, you know, as you know, I've been watching, you know, I'm one of the, you know, did the whole Ed Buck situation.
Right. You broke the story. You stayed with the story until this man was convicted.
I'm still with the story.
Still with the story, right?
Go to court in a couple weeks.
So, not to cut you off, but like, you know, in in the world of journalism, I feel like there's a general respect that's given to people that break stories and have had the traction that you've had with Ed Buck, to where that person will be seen as the go-to person on mm-hmm. that subject. You know what I'm saying? No questions. Do you feel like you've been offered that same respect as a Absolutely Black woman not. On the Ed Buck story?
Absolutely not. No. They, first of all, half of mad that they didn't jump on it sooner, you know, and can't claim that glory, right? The other half are just haters because, you know, there's some idea that only when you white, but if you're white, you can do anything. But when you're Black, you have to play by certain rules. So for some reason, if you're a Black journalist, you're not allowed to also happen to be a political strategist who also happens to know a lot of people. So there, you know, did I wear my journalism hat? I absolutely did. But there were times that I took it off because I realized journalism alone wasn't going to get this man off the street.
Oh, wow.
And so I put together a whole plan. I went above and beyond. I certainly did do that because that's what it took. Wasn't nobody else doing it.
Like, can you mention some of the things?
Yeah, I mean, just dealing with the Democratic Party, calling out the politicians who took his money, going to the West Hollywood City Council, showing the families how to lobby the members of City Council in West Hollywood to make this an issue, helping to organize people who wanted to protest in front of his apartment because he stayed free long after the second person died.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And people will say, well, that's not what a journalist does. I'm sorry. That's what Jasmine does. She also happens to be a journalist. So what? Right? Because again, white people get to do whatever they want to do. They can wear, you could be the president and be a journalist. You can do whatever you want to do. But when it's Black, it's like, you got to stay in your lane and you can only do this. You're a rapper, you just be a rapper. You this, you just be this. And it's like, no, we are multi-talented and can do a whole bunch of different stuff.
Right.
And I tell people all the time, and I don't have a problem talking about what I did because I know what I did. You know, I mm-hmm. did do that work because it was important. And yeah, am I happy my journalism helped? Yes. But it wasn't just my journalism. I had to be a strategist. I had to call Fox News. I had to call these channels. I had to argue with these people. Why aren't you covering this? I had to basically treat it like it was a campaign as well. Mm. You know, and then finally, after the second person died, people start, oh, there may be something here. You know? Never mind the dozen or so Black men that stepped forward and said, hey, he did this to me too, but I didn't die. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I just find all of it fascinating. But what I find even more fascinating is the white folk, with the help of some Black folk, that like to come in and take these victory laps now that he's sitting in jail, not prison, he's still in jail, y'all. Mm-hmm. And like they doing all these documentaries and stuff. And I'm like,
right. I don't remember seeing
you. One, who the hell are you?
Right.
Two, where the hell have you been? Three, how much of the proceeds of the money that you got paid to do this doc did you send to the victims of Ed Buck while you out here taking your victory lap?
Right.
Under the name of, oh, Black Lives Matter. Well, show us all Black Lives Matter because we ain't seen a dime. None of them victims of, the families ain't seen a dime from none of these people. Mm. You know? But I ain't worried about them because I'm doing my own documentary, actually a docu-series. Yeah, and since everybody's only going to talk to me, you know, I'll mm-hmm. have all the
exclusives.
Why wouldn't they talk to me? I helped them get the justice that they were going after.
Right.
And I've been there every step of the way. I wasn't a Jackie come lately.
Right.
I've been there pretty much since a couple of days after Jamel Moore was found dead in Ed Buck's home. Up until today. And we still going to court. That's another thing. Why are you taking victory laps when this man ain't even in prison yet? He ain't even been sentenced yet. And we ain't even had a victory party taking a victory lap. And y'all out here making movies and taking victory laps.
Right.
On to somebody else's work.
Right. Which is, I'm glad you mentioned that, because for people that might not be in journalism, they might not understand, like, okay, well, why is that even important? Like, at least they're giving it more light. But it's like, if you're a journalist and you're working, like, you know, and you're independent too, So you weren't like getting
intentionally
paid.
Independent.
Right. You know, because you could have pitched it somewhere, but you weren't getting paid for that Ed Buck work, you know? And so the how you mentioned, you know, being strategic and showing his family routes of how to fight for justice and, you know, contacting news stations and pushing for more coverage and things like that. You laid the groundwork, right? So anybody who wasn't there at that time is basically having to kind of go off of your work.
They steal it all off my social media and our website. They take it all off of that because I refuse to give them anything.
Good.
But then I turn on TV. You know, I try, you know, I try to be like a good Christian woman. My grandparents would be very proud of me today. Mm-hmm. But I turn on TV and I see Inventing Anna. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting there. Was it Inventing Anna? Yes. The movie, the docuseries Shonda Rhimes did about the fake German heiress who's really from Russia, who scammed like all of New York's social elite or whatever. It's like, I don't know, 6 to 8 episodes. It's really well done. I actually love it.
Okay.
But I'm just like, wow, this white journalist got her story told. Because she was the one that really exposed her.
Oh.
And put a lot of work into exposing her.
Right.
And not just exposing her, but just basically telling the story of, you know. And she got a whole damn show out of it.
But why is that relevant? Like, okay, this lady scammed the...
Well, that's a whole other story. Because it was New York's social elite.
Right. I think I seen a tweet and it was like, I think it was in reference to that. But it was like, you know, basically, if you're white with an idea, then they'll just like throw money behind you. Like,
apparently,
you know,
or whatever.
But again, kudos to you, you know, because like, you know, we be out here fighting for justice for, you know, as Black people, we be marching, we be doing everything, you know what I'm saying? And a lot of times we don't actually see people arrested or, you know.
Yeah, that certainly is the truth. The opportunities to take victory laps don't always come. Right? Every now and then we might get a ruling in a court where a cop goes to prison or somebody is found guilty of something.
Right.
But you're right, it doesn't happen often. But what I do want to make sure I say is mad love and respect to my Black journalists, because we come to these stories with an understanding, with an eye and an ear, especially the ones that involve our people and our communities like yourself, that nobody else can bring. They, you know, try to imitate us, oftentimes duplicate us. But they are not us.
Right.
And, you know, there's a reason why you get calls. I get calls. The Sentinel, other Black journalists and newspapers get calls from the folks in the community. Trust.
Right.
Because they trust us. They've been reading our work, watching our work, listening to us for years, and they know we're not going to do wrong by them. And that says a lot. As someone who coaches, you know, attorneys and politicians and folks on how to deal with the media, you know, I get to see both sides of it. So I, it's always really interesting to me, but, you know, I tell people all the time that I'm nothing without my community. Like having the backing of my community means everything. Like how when I walked in here and I saw Chico and Melvin. You know, it's like everywhere I go, it's like, hey, Jasmine. Or, hey. And it's like, that's what I love being home. I'm like, yes. Because, you know, my people always have my back no matter what. Because as journalists, we've had their back.
Right.
As community leaders, we've had their back. And, you know, and I want young people in particular, because I have a lot of admiration for some things I can't stand about young people and some things I have a lot of admiration for. One of the things I have admiration for is that young people understand you can do more than one thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think for my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation, like my grandparents were like, get you a good government job and you stay in that government job until it's time for you to retire. And then you retire and you take cruises. Like that was life to them. That's what you did. You did not stray from that, right? Okay. Along the way, you get married, you have some kids, you buy a house, but you get that government job, right? The younger end of my generation, ex-lineals, millennials, you know, Generation Xers, we understand that. Definitely Generation Z gets that. You can do more than one thing, and you should do more than one thing, because if the pandemic taught you nothing other than how to wash your hands properly, it should have taught you that having a way to market all of your skills and having multiple income streams is of benefit to you.
Definitely.
Right?
Right.
And it comes in handy, whether it's building websites, whether it's data entry, whether it's doing voiceover work from home or writing for websites or whatever it was. This was the past 2 years was an opportunity for people to discover, hey, maybe I can step out on my own, or hey, I can do this in addition to this.
Right.
You know, and I think that's a beautiful thing. We have to stop putting people in these boxes where, you know, and then also just not giving people their respect. I have so many awards on my wall in my office for being a journalist. The LA Times don't ever want to call me a journalist. They never want to call. It's like, it almost like it offends them.
Because it puts you like in the same playing field as them. And you're not employed by them though. Like, so they hate it.
But they'll call other people journalists.
What do they call you? Political?
Don't do half the crap that it depends on the story. If you're writing, if you're using me in a story about something that I did or wrote, you need to credit me as a journalist if I tell you that.
Right.
If I tell you to credit me as the founder of Cheerios, you better credit me as that. That's the way it goes these days. As far as I understand,
it's what people think.
It's whatever. If I feel I am white today and I come in here and tell you I am a white woman, you have to say Jasmine is a white woman.
Self-perceived white woman, you know, self-identifying. You know, but that's
basically the world that we live in now, right? Except for that.
Right.
And it's always interesting to me how they, you know, white, particularly, and people, yes, I have an issue with the LA Times, but I also subscribe. They're on my porch every morning because as someone who works in politics
information,
I have to read the paper. And I actually read the paper. I don't this the paper. I this the paper. And so, you know, yes, I do it because I want to make sure that I can maintain my level of reading. You know, you stop writing and reading and just typing and, you know, you forget how to do stuff. So I actually do read the papers in my bag right now.
In that Teflon. Shout out to you for getting one of those Teflon bags. That is so hard.
Really? I hear people say it is.
Well, if you go online.
I've had mine for a little while, though.
Okay.
I didn't use it for like 6 months after I got it, and then I decided to start using it.
They popping now, man. Them,
good for you. I'm so happy.
Uh-huh.
That's a Black-owned company.
I know. What, $250? That's probably a $500 bag.
They were calling them the Brooklyn Birkin bag.
Period. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what's up.
I support Black artists every chance I get.
Period. So you, for your work, you know, you said that you like to focus on politics and social issues.
Race, politics, and social issues.
In particular, as a woman in the queer community, you definitely want to highlight the issues facing the LGBTQ community.
Black LGBTQ community.
Right, exactly. Excuse me. So, I know that like in the Black community, especially coming from the inner city, there's like still a lot of issues with like understanding queer identities, right? But I mean, we're in 2022. So like, do you think that in the Black community, there is more understanding of Black LGBTQ identities?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, to my disgust, you know, the queer community then gave up everything. Everybody know what Kiki mean now. Everybody know what a ball is. I mean, there is very little that still is. I mean, we are, as Black people, we just love to give up our stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew the world was coming to an end when a white man said to me, when people show you who they are, you should believe them. Am I in the Twilight Zone? So we done gave up all the goods. They know all our secret code words.
Right.
You know, I don't know. I mean, what is there not to understand? I mean, everywhere I go now, I hear, you know, Black cisgender head. I don't. Black straight women.
Okay.
Kiki. And I'm just like,
wait, that's not white men you hear saying that? That are sounding like Black
no,
women?
I hear Black women using a lot of Black gay man talk.
Okay. But wouldn't the gay men
do too? Don't get me wrong, but we were talking about Black people, right?
But wouldn't the gay men get some of what they're saying from women though? So are
not necessarily Black. Okay. Black gay men made up their own little code words. Okay. And different things. And like I said, we had, you know, they had this whole ballroom community that was underground. Now it's got TV shows. And I think folks are going to regret this one day because you know, now you're going to have, you know, little Molly Henderson walking down some ballroom runway someday as just a white cisgendered woman who wants to vogue. You know, I do believe in keeping some stuff within the family, like keeping some stuff to her. I need some co-words.
But I like Pose though. I really do like that show.
I'm not saying there was anything wrong with Pose. I'm just telling you there's a danger in giving up all of your culture. Then you end up with people like the Kardashians walking around in your braids.
Right.
Okay. Thinking they Black women.
I'm so confused now. It got me questioning where the braids come from. Like, you know, I'm just joking. And the little baby hairs. Like, did we? Baby hairs. Was that Black? You sure that wasn't Katie who started the baby hairs? You see that video the white girl talking about? She found out how to sticky bangs. That's what she called it, sticky bangs. I heard she looked crazy too, but whatever. I digress. So
sticky bangs.
Sticky bangs. It looked crazy too. It looked real crazy. Mm. But okay, so basically still a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of Black people, the Black community as a whole kind of embracing and understanding queer identities.
I don't know what there is to embrace. We all got one in our family, one or two or three or four. Right. I tell people all the time, if you don't know anyone, it's probably you. I don't understand it. People who want to go to, I go to church every Sunday. Well, have you looked closely at the choir? Have you looked closely we're gay folks are everywhere. Right. And everyone, you know, look, I'm not one of them gay folks. I walk in the room. Hi, it's Jasmine and I'm a lesbian. That's not me. Yeah. I mean, never has been me. I know some people, you know, can't live without the whole world knowing their identity. I'm perfectly fine without people knowing who I sleep with. Because just because you're a lesbian don't even mean you having sex. Ask me about that someday. Okay? Because you know.
The celibate lesbians.
Right. Hello. Goodbye. The workaholic lesbians. I got dumped. But that's a whole nother story.
That's a whole nother. It's not dumped.
But you know, I don't know. I mean, gay folks have always been a part of our communities and our families. Like, you know, and I, you know, not trying to be funny, but a lot of older people who have an issue with it, well, their generations are dying off. Mm-hmm. And as their generation dies off, you know, younger generations become the majority and their attitudes about things are different. It's called evolution.
Right.
And, you know, again, as long as ain't nobody trying to crawl up in a bed with you, what do you care?
Right.
Like, honestly, if your God is so great, he don't need your help.
Okay. So you talked about how, you know, journalism, that's something that you've basically been always doing as a writer, you know? But, and you want people to put some respect on your journalism name, period. But that's not all that you do, you know? And you've pivoted real hard into politics?
I mean, yeah, I've been in politics since early mid 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
Got my start right here in Compton, working for the chair of the Black Caucus, who at the time was Mervyn Dimely. And I thank God for that opportunity. Honestly, didn't know anything about politics, came to work for him, and had a master's in it by the time I left.
Okay, okay.
Left him, went to work in Congress for Congresswoman Richardson as her press secretary, came back from D.C., decided there was more money in consulting, which there was. And I decided to start consulting. All the white boys were doing it and making tons of money. But the thing was, they were doing it in our community.
Mm.
They were running races in communities they weren't even stepping foot in.
Mm.
And still are.
Hmm.
Black politicians are still hiring white people to run campaigns in the hood. That's a whole nother conversation. Mm. But I persevered and, started teaching politicians about websites and social media. And because I was a journalist and had certain relationships with the media, I was able to get a lot of stuff done. And, fast forward, 15 or so years later, I've worked for 5 mayors. I've worked for the president of the LA City Council. I've worked for several governments. Even worked for a police union as a consultant. So, I'm pretty proud of the work that I've done. I really, mm-hmm. really, truly am, because I started, I started at the bottom and now I'm here. When you in politics, it's all about who you know.
Right.
And people trusting you.
Right.
Particularly in the work that I do, political consulting and strategy and communication, people have to trust you with their image. They're basically putting their image in your hands to be, and I'm proud of the work that I've done for the folks that I've worked for and continue to work with. I've been a candidate myself, won my first office in 2020.
Hmm.
So, it's been an interesting ride. Still right. Still was finding a way to get Ed Butt convicted, doing all of this and all of that all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we salute you, Jasmine, for your,
Thank you. Your
hustling and your making own way, paving your own way. You definitely been inspiration to me since before I came back out here, just in terms of keeping up with people, media in LA, it's not, in the recent years, especially with the whole Black Lives Matter thing, you're starting to see a little bit more. I see a couple of more faces of Black people in journalism in LA, but there's not many of us, what I'm saying? It's still, I feel like a handful of folks, just from what I see, it's still pretty white centered and dominated in LA. But no, we creating shifts, you feel me, period. So I did want to ask you, I know for me personally, like politics was something that I was just like, I don't think that that's really beneficial for Black people, you know what I'm saying? But I'm seeing the progress that other groups of people are able to make when they're organized and have something that they're pushing for, and then some other behind the scenes politics. But so I'm like, dang, like if Black people kind of continue to sit on the sidelines, like we're going to be at the bottom of this political spectrum. You know what I'm saying? We're seeing executive orders signed over here, over there. You know what I'm saying? So from your role and what you're doing now, how have you come to see the importance of politics, and particularly for Black communities?
So I always thought politics was important for Black communities once I came to work for Mr. Dimely. Like I learned, in school we're going over 20 years now, right?
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line is this. There are some things, you know how they always like to say taxes and death are the only things you can depend on that you can depend on in life.
Mm-hmm.
So is politics. Government ain't going nowhere. Now, you either can have a say-so in your government, or you can just live under your government and not have a say-so and let it run all over you.
Right.
Black people are in a very precarious position. They keep pushing us out of L.A., out of Southern California with the high rents, the high cost of home ownership, the lack of living jobs that pay a living wage. So we moving out to places like Lancaster and Palmdale, Riverside, San Bernardino, Las Vegas in Texas, and reversing the trips that our grandparents and our great grandparents took and moving back down south because it's cheaper and you can have a better quality of life than you can in LA, which is really a shame. But each one of us that does that dilutes our voting power. And when your power comes in your numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so our voting, I mean, we're 6% of the population here. Mm. So that's not really good
at all,
which is why you see a handful of Black people in elected office. But that number is going to become a fingerful in a minute because we just did redistricting. We're about to go through a contentious election cycle. We have lots of Black and brown people running against each other. Lots of Black and Black people running against each other.
Right.
And districts were rewritten certain ways to benefit certain communities. And so all of these things are going to change. And in the end, 10 years from now, there might only be half of the amount of people elected that are Black now will be in office.
Oh, that's terrible. How do we combat that? It's trying to stay in LA as much as we can, basically.
Well, you better get some elected officials in office that want to talk about more than just, this is a much longer conversation, but people have got to stop being fooled by elected officials who claim to care about the rising cost of housing, but aren't doing anything about it.
Hmm.
We need more affordable housing for who? Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
Like, you got follow-up questions to everything, right?
Right.
Everything. Because as far as I'm concerned, until our government is ready to put a cap on the amount of rent that a landlord can charge in specific areas for a certain amount of square footage,
right,
there's no conversation to be had. As long as people can charge $5,000 a month for 800 square feet, who is there to talk about? Like, you understand what I'm saying? Like,
right.
And until the prism is, I guess, reversed. So now when we build houses, we'll say 80% are market rate and 20% are affordable for who housing. When it should be 80% are affordable for who housing and 20% are market rate.
Right.
Right? But that's not the way it is. We are still catering towards developers. Everybody is.
Right.
And so until we get, and it'll be very hard because the apartment association lobby, the real estate lobby, they're a big lobby and they spend lots of money to buy politicians.
Right.
You know, and these are the same politicians smiling in your face, kissing your baby.
not the baby
that you love so much and you think, if I like her so much, keep on liking her because she owns her own. Okay,
well, look, so you mentioned, you know, like us not having many Black people in the city, right? And then you talk about the amount of Black people that are just like not involved in the political process, right? So you only really have a certain amount or certain type of Black people that are willing to even run for this office, right? And so Black people, we see another Black person, we feel like, okay, that's what we need to do. We need to vote this Black person in because they're Black, and we're not going to have any representation if we don't, you know? So it's like, how do we support
the right Black person?
The right Black person.
You do your homework. And if all else fails, come ask me. I'm gonna tell you, sure.
What are some things that people should look for when they're researching these political candidates?
Who they taking money from?
Mm-hmm.
What their past track record has been? Whether or not they really from the community?
Right.
I mean, there are some other things I look for, but you know, they might not be of interest. I mean, they wouldn't be politically correct. Let's just say that.
Okay, okay.
But I like to know, you know, who you married to and what community did you choose to settle in? Like, these are all things that tell me what kind of person you are as a person, you know?
Okay.
But really, we have to do our research. We have got to, you know, we have to treat the election of the people who represent us the same way we treat our bills. We don't just pay our bills without looking at the bill.
Right.
Like, we look at the, this bill is $10 higher than it was last month. Why? You start looking through the wattages, seeing where, did they add a new tax on there or something? We have to do the same thing. It's only for a few months, every couple of years, but we have to do our due diligence. Mm-hmm. Because these are the people that raise our electricity rates, raise our property taxes, raise our water bill rates.
Right.
These are the people that have a significant amount of control over our life. People want to sit on the sidelines because they're scared of being tricked by another sheriff's candidate like they were with Alex Villanueva. So they're like, oh, I'm just not going to get involved. I'm just going to tell. That don't mean you're not going to have a sheriff. That just means you're going to have a sheriff that you had no say-so in.
Right.
But you're going to have, LA going to have a sheriff. Trust and believe me. Sitting on the sidelines isn't going to help us. Sit, you know, all the, it's not for us. The system isn't for us. No system ever here has been for us.
Right.
You know, the rap music industry isn't for us either. Because who you think is getting rich off of me being called a B word and hoe and, you know, brothers being called N word all day? I guarantee you at the top of the building is not one of us. So let's be clear. Nothing in this country was ever for us, except for maybe some jail, prison cells. They probably made that specifically for us.
Mm-hmm.
But let's, you know, let's stop lying and kidding ourselves that that's some real excuse. You know, oh, you know, political system is a force. And just, you know, it's just, ah, hello and goodbye. Come up with something better, because that ain't it.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about, before we close out, you growing up in L.A.,
I didn't grow up in LA.
Oh yeah, I keep saying that. Compton slash Hermosa.
I mean, I came to LA. Look, you know, I'm gonna write a book about this one day, I swear, because it is actually fascinating. But no, okay. I grew up in Hermosa Beach. Yeah, that's my parents' why. I grew up in Hermosa Beach.
Well, we had just talked about this. What was life growing up for you in general?
In Hermosa Beach?
Yeah.
It was fun. I was a kid. I mean, you know, for the most part, I didn't even know I was Black.
Oh, for real?
I grew up in Hermosa Beach in the 80s in a very sheltered environment.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know anything about racism, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean.
Which way is Hermosa Beach?
It's next to Manhattan Beach, which is next to Redondo Beach. So it's.
Yeah, it's right there.
Yeah. But this is the 80s and I'm a kid. So what do I know?
Right.
I mean, I grew up listening to rock music and playing at the beach with all my white friends, me and my sisters. When my parents got divorced, you know, things changed because my mom kept the place in Hermosa Beach. My dad, my granddaddy gave my dad my great-grandma's old house in Compton. My granddaddy owned a lot of property in Compton. And my great-grandma had just passed and her house was vacant. So my dad needed a house and it was a 3-bedroom house. So my dad gave it to my grandmother. I mean, my dad gave it to my grandfather, gave it to my dad.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting because, you know, we didn't go to school with the neighborhood kids, but we didn't go to school with the neighborhood kids, but we played with them because we still went to school in Hermosa Beach. My parents didn't want to move us out of the school district, because Hermosa Beach was a great school district. This is 80s. Come on now.
Okay? Right.
And then one thing led to another, and I was having a lot of difficulty adjusting to my parents' divorce, which, you know, I know it's hard for parents, sometimes for parents to stay together. I just want to say it does have a tremendous, tremendous effect on your young children's life. It really does. And it had a tremendous effect on my life. And my parents were having their issues, and one thing led to another, and I ended up in the foster care system. My sisters didn't, but I did. So I ended up in the system at 13, and I stayed in the system till I was emancipated when I was 17.
Oh, wow.
And those were like the hardest years ever for someone who's not. I was put in, my first group home was on Arlington and Jefferson.
Oh, wow.
I know nothing about LA. They put me in Fauchet. I was at a high school. Because where I was coming from, ninth grade was high school.
Okay.
But then when I came to LA, ninth grade was junior high. It was seventh, eighth, ninth back then. Mm. So Fauchet was seventh, eighth, ninth. So I went to Fauchet. I swear to God, it was like, whoa, Jasmine. Like, I had to learn how to fight. I had to learn how to, oh my God, I had to learn a lot. I learned a lot in a short period of time. I really, really, really did. And I credit my time in group homes and in placement for making me as independent as I am. It really made me an independent person because I really felt like I didn't have, I mean, you know, I would go home on the weekends to my grandparents and stuff, but for the most part, you stuck with these girls that you don't even know. Most of the time they want to steal and fight you. You know, it was just a constant. Well, I was so happy to be out the system. I remember the day I went to court to get emancipated. I was so happy. I was like, ooh, let me get out of here. And I left at 17. I didn't even make it to 18 because I was already finished with school. So I got out.
Oh, wow.
And they didn't have all these fancy programs.
Transitional housing.
Yeah, they did not, that didn't exist back then.
What did you do when you were emancipated?
I worked.
Hmm. Do you remember?
I tried to go to college part-time and work full-time, and I ended up just working full-time. There are a lot of things I wanted to do that I didn't get to do educationally because I had to take care of myself. There was nobody else to take care of me. You know, I saw some of my friends end up getting pregnant and having like a lot of kids because back then it was like a guaranteed thing where you could get like Section 8 and you get a check every month. So that was like one way they knew that they could take care of themselves, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like I feel like they sacrificed, you know, like they could have done something else, but they did that because they knew that that was a way they could take care of themselves. I had people I was in placement with that ended up going to the streets and being prostitutes. Girls that's all they had, you know? Like, because there was no transitional programming for my generation back then. Mm. That's why the women that I was in placement with that I'm still in touch with today, like, I have a lot of love for them because we went through a lot. Like, we really didn't have anything but ourselves. And there were times, like, I remember there was one time I was in between places when I was younger, and I ended up staying with one of my foster sisters at her place.
Mm.
Like, I would babysit her kids for her while she went to work. You know, like, you know, that's my, like, I have an extended family of the women I was able to stay in touch with from my placement. We all in our 40s now. But, you know, I remember when we were teenagers, you know, wilding out.
Hmm. Okay. So what advice would you give to young Black folks that want to get into the field of journalism?
Well, clearly I would tell them to do it, but I think I would also tell them to find what their passion is.
Mm-hmm.
I would tell them not to limit themselves to just journalism because you never know, you could blend journalism with legal, you could blend journalism with politics like I have. Like, there are different avenues, right? Journalism is one of those interesting industries that is always evolving, right? So now we have multimedia journalists. You know, it used to be back in the day, like, you wrote for a newspaper and it was in a newspaper. But now you can write for tons of websites and be seen by even more people. You can do vlogs, you can do podcasts. Like, there's all different types of journalism. And I know for like a lot of the old head journalists, that pisses them off because they think everything should always stay the same. But the new journalism world, I think, is really exciting because it's also given people, much like music and MP3s and YouTube and SoundCloud did for artists, these mechanisms are giving journalists a way to bypass the mainstream media and go directly to their audience.
Right.
One of the things that I love, like I did this interview recently with somebody and they were like, they kept asking me, so like when you go to the mainstream to publish, and I kept saying, how many times do I have to explain to you, lady, I have my own following. I don't go to anybody. Like I put my stuff on my Medium or my blog and it gets seen and read and shared. Like unless I intentionally have a deal with a newspaper or a website or something, like I'm not just, you know, it was like a hard concept for her to believe. And I'm like, you know, I've been doing this for a while now, so I kind of have a little bit of a name. So I just kind of, you know, yeah, just publish my own stuff.
Period.
And there are times I do go to like an LA magazine or an Advocate or a Sentinel, whatever, if I think it's the appropriate audience for something. Plus, it doesn't hurt to, you know, step outside and, you know, remind people you're still here, you know, kind of thing. But I love the fact that we can't have, I've had a blog for like 20 years now, before people were blogging and it was a thing. I had a blog and I'm really proud of that. My first blog was with TypePad. I don't know if you remember that, but it used to be a, so super old. Like MySpace old.
Okay. I remember Blogger and all that.
I never was on Blogger though. I don't think I was ever on Blogger.
Okay.
But yeah. TypePad. So now I'm at IamJasmine.com because I am Jasmine.
Period.com. Right.
So
make sure you head over there, subscribe. You have a subscribe link right on the website, right? Yeah, of course. And Instagram, you're on Instagram at
Hello Jasmine.
Twitter.
I'm Jasmine on Twitter because I've been on Twitter long enough to have my own name.
So it just says Jasmine.
It's just says same thing with Facebook, Jasmine. Been on Facebook long enough to have my name.
Period. And Jasmine spelled JASMYNE.
Yeah.
Canic. And before we close out, is there anything that you want the people to know that you feel like we did not touch on? But I feel like I didn't even read these questions because it kind of just came up in conversation.
It's fine. Look, you know, I'm super proud of you.
Oh, and, thank you. Likewise.
You know, I think the world of you. I love the work that you do and the dedication you put into it. And the level of consciousness you bring to everything you do. I think you represent us very well. And when I say us, I mean Black people, Black women, Black journalists. I just think you do a really excellent job at that. Don't ever be discouraged. Know that there are people who support you and who are reading what you write and watching what you post. And we, you know, you're the next generation of journalism here in our community. So thank you very, very much for everything that you do.
Well, that means a lot, Jasmine. Thank you so much. And, you know, thanks for paving the way. You feel me? Like, we're nobody.
I'm not going yet, girl.
No. Of course. But, you know, set things in stone so that somebody like me can come through and be, you know, even appreciated in that light. You know what I'm saying? Because you had broke down barriers and doors for me to be able to do something like this. So thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. And salute to, you know, you paving your own way as well. And we are definitely staying tuned for Jasmine Canic's Ed Buck series. And it's not, you know, it's just a general level of respect. And also you're the source. That is the story that you worked on. Anybody else is going to have to come and look at your work to tell the story. So why not you tell the story, you know? So I get you, though, because, you know, I went through a similar situation, kind of. Nothing like the level that you were able to get him arrested and things like that. But just in terms of advocating for Black life that was lost, no one really caring, or they cared, but you were the main voice on it. And I don't think that, like, a lot of people, well, for me, I was in a small white town advocating for a dead Black murdered student and then using my website to, like, rival what was being written by the white people, you know, like they was gaslighting me. They was like, you know, targeting me. Thankfully, it was no physical, nothing that manifested physically. It was all online stuff, you know, but having to go through that level of stress and as a Black person by yourself doing that in a secluded place, like it was very stressful. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And then we were asking for more support from larger media people that we were not getting support or coverage. And then, you know, I'm saying like, hey, I'm in meetings with the police department and this kid's mother. And there's information that I'm hearing that these newspapers, they're not in here. So they're not hearing it. So it's not making it to the print. So I'm having to say that. But I'm basically putting myself on Front Street to, you know, talk about how this investigation has been basically they dropped the ball, the police, through their lack of thorough investigation or just sloppiness. They botched the investigation is what I was saying from the get-go, from me being in meetings. And then after kind of, you know, a year or two passed, no, definitely like 2 years. Then here comes some white folks. They done came up there, drove up there, did a documentary, you feel me? But I'm like, I never seen none of y'all around, you know? And I'm all of the stuff's on my website. So I keep seeing people reading this, even though, you know, so I don't know if that's you, but I know that if you research this kid's murder, you have to come across my work. You know what I'm saying? Like, and then the other side of the botched investigation that was coming from me, because the white media were saying, oh no, the police are doing, you know, their investigation and reposting press releases from the police, not doing their own investigative journalism. So it was a lot, you know. So I was very surprised when I look up and it's white folks now doing documentaries on this student murder, talking about how the small town police force botched the investigation. I'm like, the fuck? That's what I said.
Did you reach out to them?
I surely did. This one lady, Caucasian ma'am, gonna tell me she don't know who I'm is. She don't know who I'm is. I said, well, that's interesting. She was like, I've been working on this documentary for 5 months. I was like, that's interesting because I was up there living that for over a year. You know what I'm saying? In meetings with the police and his mom, asking the police questions, right? To where the lawyer was sitting there just writing notes. And she telling me afterwards, wow, I think you would be a great litigator or something like that. I don't know what she mean, but it's like, you know, I didn't see the documentary lady in a meeting with us, you know, and me. With me asking the police questions about their procedure when they got there, when the kid was stabbed, what happened, like, you know what I'm saying? Why it took the ambulance so long to come and retrieve him. She was like, yeah, I've been working on this for 5 months. And I was like, well, either you are blowing smoke up my butt right now, or you didn't do no real, real thorough research, because there's no way you didn't come across my work to write about this kid's murder. No way. Especially with the narrative that you're saying about a botched investigation. So I digress, but so that's why, like, you know, I can see the issues with the whole Ed Buck thing and people that we know were not there. And that's fine that you want to do your renditions, but you should at least be reaching out to the source. And I feel like they completely X us out of our own stories that they wouldn't do that to, like,
Katie Couric. They just wanted me to give them everything for free and just do their job, basically, for them, just give up all my work to them. And I'm not doing that.
Yeah, that's out.
No, them days is over.
Definitely. So yeah, your own docuseries. And, you know, I've been thinking about something that I could do to talk about maybe like student murders in these small towns. You know what I'm saying? Like, because from my coverage, you know, on my website, a lady reached out to me and was like, hey, you know, something like this happened out here before. You know, 17 years ago, my friend was a student at HSU. He got into a fight with somebody in the town, a white guy. He got killed. And for some reason, the police couldn't make the connection for the arrest, you know? So we got two Black students in the same town, 17 years apart. Same thing happened, but there's no, you know, there's like a prime suspect. The prime suspect is from the town. These are students, Black male students. And for some reason, the police can't make a arrest and conviction. And so, you know, just doing some research, there's other Black men in the Cal State system, university system that have, you know, their parents sent them away to school and they end up dead, you know? So I think that is an issue, a bigger issue we could be talking about Black death at college campuses. But yeah. I digress. But so yeah, make sure you guys go to iamjasmine.com. Or is it Canic?
Nope, I'm Jasmine.
I am Jasmine, and follow Jasmine on Instagram.
Hello, Jasmine.
Follow Jasmine on Twitter.
Jasmine.
And make sure you support our Black women in media, our Black political strategists, our Black journalists, and support Black media, because that's important, right. Too. That's important, too. And
thank you.
Like this episode?
Leave a review and stay up to date on new episodes by subscribing to Sloss and Girl Speaks. And follow Sloss and Girl on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook.